Blog Talk Radio.
Well, that was interesting. I guess our show, I guess our song came on before we went on the air. Well, that's what happens.
Go ahead, Andre. You're on.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. You're on.
Okay, I sort of thought so. This is Andre Traversa. Welcome this morning to the Cosmic Citizen. You're going to have to deal with me eating breakfast on the air this morning, folks. But as you know, I'm here. I'm here, and what else can I say about myself? Completely open, completely transparent, in the flesh, warts and all. So this is Andre Traversa with you on the Cosmic Citizen. I'm hosting the show solo today with Larry Watkins helping us out, our techie. And for those of you who don't know, Larry does an absolutely marvelous job for us on the air.
Well, thanks.
And is just an absolutely... just does a lot of phenomenal stuff behind the scenes. He's the one who gets books accessible to me so I can read them. He puts up our bios. He does all kinds of stuff. So everybody should know about what a great job Larry does. And we're gonna have another. We have another Larry with us. Actually, Paula is not available today. She's not going to be with us. She is involved in some Uranchabook Fellowship business. And in the meantime, we have another Larry with us. We have Larry Mullins with us. Larry Mullins. I was with us before, I think last September, I think of 2008, he did an interview with us about the Urantia, the history of the Urantia movement, actually. And now what he's doing is he's got a book right now called The Meta Values Breakthrough. It's built largely on the work of psychologist Abraham Maslow, but also has a lot of very important concepts that we find in the Urantia book. And Larry, welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, thank you, Andre. Good to be here. Hey, Larry Watkins, good to talk to you. Good to hear your voice.
Hi, Larry, yeah.
So tell us again, tell us what meta-values are, because I think a lot of people listening to the program just have no idea what that means.
Yeah, well, the meta-values are the highest values of truth, beauty, and goodness that the Urantia book expels so much. And one thing about the meta-values breakthrough, it's not a self-help book, it's a meta-values help book. It's the premise is that we can't lift ourselves, but we can be lifted if we allow ourselves to be lifted.
Mm.
That's kind of the broad concept of it.
That's a great idea. Abraham Maslow was actually one of my favorite psychologists while I was in high school and college. And I'd like to talk a little bit about him first. Because I think he coined this term, meta-values, didn't he?
He called them being values. And this whole discussion and why we're Urantians and why we read the Urantia book and why we want to improve ourselves is all about consciousness, about raising our consciousness, that we're able to do that, that that's a possibility for a human being to raise their level of consciousness. It's an extremely important issue. When you talk about being values, many people can't understand that. You know, when you say truth, beauty, and goodness, Maslow declared were being values. What does being mean? And I'll give you an example from St. Augustine. He would tell his students, he'd say, would you rather have a precious pearl or an ordinary field mouse? And, of course, the answer is obvious. You wouldn't. You'd rather have the pearl. Then he would say this. He would say, would you rather be a precious pearl or an ordinary field mouse? And the answer suddenly changes. Why is that? It's because a non-being for a human being would be unthinkable. It's fine for a pearl, but at least a field mouse has some volition. So the being values are about raising consciousness, the higher levels of consciousness. And that's what Maslow, that was what he talked about. I was reading him back when I first read the Urantia book in a serious way. At the same time I was reading that, I'd had the Urantia book about 4 or 5 years, and I read it, and it was just another book. Clyde Bedell gave it to me. And it was about that time I lost my daughter, my 13-year-old. So it might be a good time to just tell that story.
Well, I want to tell that story, but I want to do that. What I want to do, Larry, is tell that story when we talk about the issue of resentment.
Okay, we can do that. That's fine.
That's one of the chapters in your book is how to overcome resentment. Mm-hmm. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. And by the way, for those who want to call in and talk about meta values with us, you can call us at 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. What I want to get into here, Larry, though, is first, let's talk a little bit about Abraham Maslow and
sure.
who he was. Because Abraham Maslow was a founder of something called, one of the founders of something called humanistic psychology. And that's a term that can be very easily misunderstood, because I think a lot of people, when they think of humanism, they think of secular humanism or something. But this is actually, humanism actually in this case was something that's closer to what we believe as the Urantians. It was actually a revolt against behaviorism. Talk a little bit about what that was about.
Yeah, Maslow was a behaviorist at the beginning. He had 180 IQ, and he was also a Freudian psychologist at the very beginning. He changed his mind about that the human, which is a premise, is that the human personality is completely malleable by their environment and their heredity. These two factors were the only factors that influenced human behavior. Well, Maslow, when he had his first child, his wife had his first child, watched it and became convinced that there was more to it than that. Now, he never denied Freudism or behaviorism. He only said that they were incapable of explaining other things in human behavior that seemed to be beyond the malleable part of human nature, that there were other things intrinsic in human nature that couldn't be explained that way.
So when we hear the word humanistic psychology, and in this case, you know, humanism, what do we mean by humanism here? We don't mean...
Well, let's do this, Andre. Let's just talk about how Maslow changed his mind about all
this. Okay.
He was a professor at Brooklyn College back in the late 30s. He had just gotten his PhD, and he arrived at Brooklyn College, and he was surrounded by some of the most brilliant people that he'd never seen so much brilliance and genius. And he said that it was like the new Athens, that New York was like the new Athens. It was so phenomenal, and he was so impressed by all that. Well, the reason that this existed was because all these people had migrated from Europe because of the Nazi menace. Many of them were Jewish, most of them were Jewish, and they were some of the greatest minds in psychology and philosophy and science that had ever been massed in one place at once, all in New York City. So he was just awed by that. And even with his 180 IQ, he was impressed by what he saw. But there were two of them that were different than the rest of them. Two of them stood out, and he was fascinated by these two people. One of them was Ruth Benedict, who was an anthropologist, and the other was Max Wertheimer, who was a scientist who had discovered the Gestalt theory. But they were very accomplished. She studied the Blackfoot Indians and the Native Americans before it was politically correct to do so, and he discovered Gestalt theory. But what fascinated Maslow about them wasn't this. It was that they were such gracious, good people. They were like what we would imagine people who were the followers of Jesus would be. They were very interested in other people. They were very respectful of ordinary people. They were just different and enlightened and very mature. And Maslow was so fascinated by the beauty of their personalities that radiated from him, he began to take notes. And he was taking notes on both of them and trying to figure out just what made him tick. And then one night he was looking at this list, two lists, this is where the big breakthrough came through. He realized he was not looking at two different people. Even though one of them had grown and had an unhappy marriage, she got her degree later in life and had a very unhappy childhood, and came from America, and the other guy came from Europe, which was battle war-torn, and he was a lawyer and a musician before he had his findings. So they were very different, but they had all these characteristics that were alike. And he said, wait a minute, I'm looking at a kind of person. that was his first discovery of the self-actualizing person. And that's when he started on his mission to discover what makes these people, this 1%, different than everybody else.
Wow. Well, one of the things I love about what you're describing and what Maslow was doing is that he was interested in people based on their health, not based on just on pathology. The common Freudian approach, as you point out, was to look at people based on pathology, based on what was wrong with them. And so I think what Maslow was trying to say, you know, what if we made a psychology or created a psychology based on healthy people and use those as the model rather than sick people?
That's exactly right. That's the whole thing. He wondered, what if there are more people like this? What if we learned what they do and started emulating them rather than trying to find all the sick people and figure out what's wrong with them? Let's study healthy people and see how they got that way. And that's the fascinating thing that's what I found fascinating.
Yeah. So what are the characteristics then of a self-actualized person?
Well, there's kind of a list of those, but you hear them and then they kind of go away. But basically, the self-actualized person, there's no such thing as a self-actualized person. They're self-actualizing. It's a process.
Okay.
Anyway, they enter into that process. The thing that I think is the most important, though, are the blocks. And I went into detail about that, there's a few blocks that we all carry with us that keep us from entering that process. So if you took Maslow's pyramid and you go up a pyramid, you get to self-actualizing. You notice it goes to a point at the top. I opened that up into a spiritual progress based on the Urantia papers and the Kingdom of Heaven paper, which I found very interesting. But what happens with self-actualizers is they do three things different than the rest of us. And the three things are they continually make growth choices rather than safety decisions.
Okay, let's go through these one by one. And by the way, a lot of people may not be familiar with what Maslow's pyramid is, so why don't we describe that first?
Well, that was what he was most famous for, and it's kind of a yawner in 101 still. But what he discovered was we all have certain urges and need gratification, and there's a hierarchy. So it starts with the biology that we need air, food, water, of course, to survive. And once those are satisfied, and until they're satisfied, we don't have an urge for anything else. But once we have food to eat and we're okay, then we start thinking about safety. We try to make our environment safe. And once we have the safety issues covered, something new emerges, and that's the social needs that we need to associate with other people, the kind of herd instinct. We want people around us. We want to belong to something. And then once these desires and you have the social behavior and you're okay with that, the next thing that emerges is the need to excel, the esteem needs, to be better, to be stand out in this social group, to be somebody more important. That becomes predominant. And then you go into the self-actualizing process once all those issues are satisfied. But what I discovered was once you get past this esteem thing and into self-actualizing, there are really blocks that are prevalent that most of us suffer from before we can get into that 1% that are really making it. And I guess the best way I like to explain the self-actualizing process is with experience rather than a list of qualities, creative and things like that. If everyone has had peak experiences. When I talk to these college kids up here in St. Augustine at Flagler College, I really enjoy them because they're young and they believe all. They really buy this stuff. But they all of them admitted that they had had peak experiences. So anybody who happens to be listening has had the experience of elation and joy that suddenly occurs to them, just happens to them, and they feel like everything's falling into place and
right,
working.
Right.
Well, that rare feeling is kind of a way of life for self-actualizers. They embrace that level of consciousness much more fully than we do. Once we learn how to do that, once we know what it feels like, it feels great. That feeling is what we're striving for. That's happiness. That's when we are totally in the flow. They call it flow. Athletes call it in the zone. And flow is one that a lot of psychologists use. That it's just the greatest feeling. That's the self-actualizing level. And I think we're given little glimpses of it spiritually. I think we're just given little shots and say, this is what it could be like if we could get into that zone.
Yeah. So, okay. So you were talking, for example, about, you said there were three things that self-actualized people do. And I want to spend a lot of time on each one of these. One is to make growth choices rather than safety choices. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, the Evangelist book talks about that too, that we need to make growth choices. Very few of us make courageous decisions. That's quite true, and most of us want to choose the safety thing, stay in our zone, keep from getting out of the comfort zone that we're in. Once we decide that we'll make growth choices, everything changes. A whole new world opens up to us, and that is extremely important. Once we are able to make growth choices, then the second thing that actualizers do that we rarely do is they have a totally invulnerable self-respect. Now, the Urantia book talks about the preeminence of the individual in the Kingdom of Heaven paper. It lists the five qualities of the Kingdom of Heaven. And they seem to fall in the hierarchy, too. But the most important thing a person needs is the preeminence of the individual is self-respect that's impregnable, that they totally believe in themselves. And that doesn't mean an egotistical thing, because it's modulated by a compassion for others. So the ultimate stage is a balance between confidence and love. Once those two are in perfect alignment, so people that are too aggressive sometimes try to curb that, but there's nothing wrong with aggressive personality as long as it's compassionate to an equal degree. And a lot of compassionate people are too goody-goody, and they find themselves being exploited. They try to curb their compassion rather than develop their assertiveness. So the two things in balance are what make it work. So they have this impregnable self-respect that Jesus talked about, that he came to restore the self-respect in those that had it, didn't have it, and curb it in those that had
right.
too much of it.
That's really important. And I want to, because, and this is, I'm going to maybe play a little bit of a devil's advocate with you, not really, but I want to clarify some things and kind of talk about the nuances of some of these things, because they are not
Get behind me, Satan.
I'm sorry?
What? Go ahead, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, here's an example. Don't you think there are times when we need to make safety decisions? I mean, you gave the example of a person who's too compassionate and maybe they need to curb their compassion. I think of women in particular, although not just women, but sometimes women who have no sense of self, and they end up in these abusive relationships with men who beat them or whatever. And so I guess what I'm saying is, for a woman like that to get out of a relationship like that and to pursue healthier relationships would be a growth choice and a safety choice.
Yeah, it would. And, when we're talking about physical safety, that's when the lower part of the pyramid kicks in, when you're physically in danger.
Right. And we need that. We need those things. They're not things that just go away. And I guess, I'll give you another example. There are situations, unfortunately I'm in a situation right now where I've talked about this on the air before. Unfortunately, I live with my mom right now. We have a very difficult relationship. And I'm in a place right now where I really don't want to work on that relationship anymore, because I'm tired of doing it. I'm just tired, because every time I try to work on it, it just ends up blowing up in my face. I basically am kind of in survival mode right now, at least in that area of my life. But I don't I don't feel a need or I don't feel a desire to change that right now. I feel like that's what I'm supposed to be doing at the moment. And so I do think there are times when we do need to turn on that safety switch and just go for self-preservation, you know, and then we don't want to stay there though. We don't want to stay on guard all the time. We don't want to stay in survival mode all the time, but there is a necessity for that.
Oh, well, yeah, specific situations, no one can give you, you can't cover all specific things with one blanket statement. However, I guess the one that always impressed me was Buckminster Fuller, who's the guy that created the geodesic dome, became a very famous man, and he was an alcoholic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was 30 years old. He was going to kill himself. He decided to end it all. And the reason he was going to do that was he was in a situation that was no way out. There was no way out for him. It was very early in this last century. He felt that he was about 30, and he felt that he would only live another 5 or 10 years because that was about your perspective lifespan at that time. And also, he had failed in business. He'd lost a child. His business was in the toilet. He was drinking all night. He was totally unhappy. He had a new child, Allegra, who I've visited with, a wonderful lady. But it was just hopeless for him. So he thought if he killed himself, at least they'd get the insurance policy. So one night he went to this lake in Lake Michigan, and he stood by the edge of it, and he's preparing to leap into it and end it all, and this voice somewhere inside said to him, "You have no right to destroy yourself. You don't belong to you. You belong to the universe."
Wow.
And he was stunned, and he said, he didn't hear a voice. He just said he felt it. And he said, "But what can I do? I'm useless. What can I do to change this world? A guy like me, and hopeless, no money, I'm broke, everything's lost, my relationships are destroyed." And then came the most important statement. It said, "You'll never know what your significance is to the universe." I think we could all learn from that. We'll never know exactly what our significance is on this planet to the universe, but you can be sure that you are doing everything you need to do if, and this is what the advice was, if you convert all experience to the benefit of the other person. Now,
so
that was you couldn't think of anything more Christian or more.
Absolutely. So it's about getting out of yourself.
Mm-hmm. So he said he applied that. He started applying that, and he said for the first time in his life he began to think for himself. He'd always bought into the assumptions of science and the a priori assumptions of science, religion, and philosophy, which the book tells us we were protected from by our reality response. So this reality response kicked in, and he started thinking for himself, and that changed everything. And then he said that every time things started to go south, if he remembered, it was always because he abandoned this principle. Once he went back to this principle, everything went good again. And he lived to be 95, I think, and a phenomenal career. He's just a wonderful, great man.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really amazing.
So
no,
I told you all that was.
So that's the time. So yeah, I'm not talking about. You know, I wasn't trying to say that it was okay to kill yourself or it was okay to. My point was simply that.
No. What I meant was that there was the principle of converting experience. Every difficult situation I've ever had that got out of hand was because I forgot that. I wasn't trying to convert the situation into the benefit of the other person.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And that's
wow.
What's tough. That's when you
yeah.
sit down.
I do. I guess I do think there is a time, though, when we have to, I hate to say this, there is a time when we do need to put ourselves first. But see, he wasn't really putting himself first either when he was trying to
kill himself. No. This is, it's just a different perspective. It's something you kind of grasp intuitively. It's hard to explain it logically.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
kind of counterintuitive to what we normally do.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. That's boy, that's hard work.
Oh, you tell me it's hard. Well, this is like I always call this like boot camp. And yeah. when we get to the other side, people say, "Oh, you came from your ranch. Wow, that must have been the Marines and the Rangers and everything else, boot camp all combined."
I want to, before we get into the other two things that self-actualizers do, I want to talk about a couple of things, and I don't mean to be negative here, but let me ask you the first thing. You talk about how we think we have limitations, but don't we all have limitations?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So what? I guess my question is, what do we? I guess the question is, what do our limitations come in? How do self-actualizing people deal with limitations? I have a good friend, Brian Cox, who was on our show. He's a psychologist in Colorado Springs. He's actually a Urantropic reader too. He said to me something that really made a lot of sense. He said there's a difference between growth and self-improvement. They're not always the same thing. Sometimes growth means accepting your limitations. Sometimes it means recognizing, you know what, I can't do this right now. Or sometimes, how does a self-actualized person deal with limitations?
Well, you know, I really can't answer that except I can tell you what I do, and I'm not.
Self-actualizing, I shouldn't say self-actualized.
Okay. Yeah, it's better to say self-actualized. What I do, which, and I'm very, I find myself limited all the time, is, for example, I had to give a very simple example. I had two classes at Flagler College this week, and I was scared to death because, you know, these are young people. You're standing up there, and they're looking at, who's this old guy? What's he got to say? You get that feeling, and you say, God, can I do this? Is this possible? And what I always ask is, I ask for the mind of Jesus, and mm-hmm. I say, there's no way that Jesus can fail. Failure is impossible. Praise God. Failure is impossible. So I can't go wrong if I feel that Jesus is leading me into this situation. And it never fails. I always feel that I'm okay in that situation when I'm there, and it always works for me. So you don't know your limitations. But sometimes we think we're limited, and we can do things far more than we think we can, but you rely on that inner guidance.
Right. I think that's true. I think if I were... Well, public speaking is not a good example for me because I love doing it, and maybe it's because I can't see the audience, so I don't have as much of a stage fright as although I still have some of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But once I get on stage, I get on that roll and get into that flow you talk about before, you know, which I think is a great concept, by the way. It's something that I've definitely experienced that. I've written stories, I've done stand-up comedy routines, and when I'm in that flow, it's such a great feeling. So I do understand what you're talking about. But I think one thing I would do if I were in a situation where I felt like I couldn't do it, but it was something I knew I was supposed to do, I think the first thing I would do is just acknowledge it and say, you know, this is what I'm feeling right now. I'm feeling like I can't do it.
Okay.
And maybe tell somebody that. And I think, and give myself permission to feel that. And then you know, if I had a big fear of public speaking, I think I would probably just tell the people I'm speaking to, you know what, this is really scary for me.
Well, that's all right. I tell somebody, I tell Jesus.
Yeah. Well, that's always the person we really need to be telling.
I mean, you know, this is beyond me. I need you. Oh, and that's from the Ranch book too. You know, that there's someone in me that can do it.
Right.
If I can't, you know.
Right. I want to talk also about this thing you call the will to fail, which is in chapter one of your book. You talk about.
Neat thing. That's cool. We only covered the first where we touched on the first. The growth decisions,
mm-hmm.
and then we talked about the, the responsibility for the. Did we talk about this responsibility for the inner life?
No. But I want to get it.
Okay.
Do that, before we get into the other things, I want to talk about this one.
Yeah, the will to fail is a fascinating thing because Maslow. There was another thing Maslow discovered, and he called it the Jonah complex. Now, Jonah, if people don't know what Jonah did, Jonah was everybody knows he was a prophet, but God told him to go to this city, Nineveh, and to preach to these people, and he was scared. He said, I'm not going to do that. So he tried to escape God, and he took a boat, and as you know what happened, they threw him in the... When they found out he was causing all these problems on the ship, they threw him overboard, and he was swallowed by a whale. And he ended up going to the city after all. But what he was trying to do, Maslow said, was escape his destiny. Most of us want to do that, and that's when you talked about limitations.
Mm-hmm.
We we tend to want to escape our destiny because it's much safer where we are. And the example I give in the book, which to me is classic, is A.J. Cronin. Now, A.J. Cronin was an author, and he wrote some fabulous books, but before he became an author, he was a doctor, and he was about 30 years old, pretty successful in London, but he hated his business. He hated being a doctor, and he hated it so much he developed an ulcer that was very nearly killed him. And he went to the doctor he went to told him, look, you've got to have 6 months complete rest. Sent him to an island off Scotland. He was completely isolated, and he sat there wondering what he's going to do with his 6 months, and he decided he would write a book because he always wanted to write a book. So he went down to the store and bought some tablets and came back and sat there and couldn't write. He couldn't do anything. He looked at this blank page, and then he remembered what his teacher told him in school was, get it down, get it down. So he started writing very clumsily this book, which he called Hatter's Castle. And it was painful, painful struggle to write a few hundred words a day. He kept this up, and he sent it out to get it typed. Now, this is the creative drive that everybody gets, this first instinct to create something. We all get that. It's just we all want to do it. Most people, this is what happens. The Jonah complex hits. At a certain point, he got back some of his typed chapters and started reading them, and the Jonah complex hit. He said, nobody will read this. This is stupid. This is terrible. I can't believe I even wrote this. Where did I get this idea? And he decided it was a complete failure, the whole project. He bundled them up. It happened to be raining, and he threw them in the trash outside. And he put on his jacket, and he decided to walk down the road, and he felt kind of triumphed that he'd gotten rid of this monkey on his back. Well, he walked down the road, and this is where fate intervened, and most of us don't have this good fortune. But he sees this guy digging in his bog, an old farmer, old Angus, and he knew him, and he walked up to him, and he was watching him and listening to him shovel, scraping, and working in the rain. And Angus stopped, and he had great respect for writers, the Scots do. He said, well, how's your book coming? And he said, well, I decided I was not really equipped to write a book, so I gave up on it. And so Angus kind of looked at him with this contempt, and he put his shovel down. He said, you know, you're probably right, and I'm probably wrong, and I've ditched this bog all my days. My father ditched this bog all his days. We were trying to make a meadow, and meadow or no meadow, I cannot help but dig. And perhaps it's the same with your wee book. And he went back to his digging, and Cronin was furious and just embarrassed, and he walked back to his house, and he thought, I'm going to at least finish the thing. I'll finish it. So he dug the stuff out of the trash, dried it in the oven, and began to write again. And his fascinating struggle he went through. The characters became real, and he would wake up in the middle of the night and write and do all kinds of things. He went on and on and on. Finally, he wrote it and finished it within the 6 months. And he sent it off to a publisher by sticking a pin in a directory, picking a publisher. Before he left, just before he left, he got a telegram they wanted to publish the book. He took it to the old Scotsman, and Scotsman just nodded and said, and that was it. The book that he almost threw away was translated into 22 languages eventually, became a movie, and completely changed his life. He became a great writer.
What was the name of the book? Was that Hatter's Castle?
Hatter's Castle, and then he wrote Keys to the Kingdom, which was one of his greater books.
When was he alive? I've heard.
Oh, this is back in the early part of the century, 20th century. The Citadel. They made movies of a lot of these. The Keys to the Kingdom they made a movie of, and the Citadel they made.
Wow,
he's a fascinating writer, wonderfully gifted man.
Because you know, one of the things that I want to give you share some thoughts with you on this will to fail before we get into it, because this is something honestly, I'm not accusing you of this, Larry, because this really wasn't the purpose of your book. but a lot of what drives me crazy, and for people who know this, some people know this about me, I'm a life coach. I've got a website, controversialcoach.com, which I will plug unapologetically. Okay, but one of the things I try to do on that site, and I've got a coaching philosophy section, is to me, one of the things that frustrates me to no end is a lot of these self-help books tell people that they've got to change, but they don't tell people how. And before I give you some thoughts on this will to fail, because I think there's a, I think there are reasons why this happened. But before I do that, let me ask you a question. Did your wife, Joan, support you a lot through the writing of this book? And in what ways did she encourage you and support you while you were writing this book?
Oh, this book?
Yes.
Well, it went on for almost our marriage. We've been married almost 20 years, and it's gone on that long. We were trying to get it published that long. So without Joan, there would be no book. There probably wouldn't be any Larry without Joan.
Okay, but what I'm asking is, just give me some. There's a reason why I'm asking this question, and I'll tell you what it is in a minute. But just in what concrete ways did your wife help you with this book?
Well, there were so many ways, but I'll tell you the most important way was when we got to the end. We had three New York editors, and essentially, there were still problems with the manuscript. It just had to be perfect, and Joan sat down and went, and not being a professional editor, but with just a will and prayers, she went through the manuscript and made it absolutely perfect. And it took her about 3 weeks, exhausting work, and that was one way.
Okay. When you were in the process of writing, did she do simple things for you, like fed you dinner or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. See, this is the reason I'm getting. Let me tell you why I'm asking this question, because one of the things that I think happens with people, that I think one of the reasons most people don't achieve their dreams, is because one of the things you talk about is you talk about how a lot of people depend too much on the opinions of others, and other people will, you know, say, well, you can't do this, or you shouldn't be doing this. That's true, okay? But here's another side to that. It's sort of a positive side of that, and that is, I believe, Larry, that just because we're adults, we don't stop needing the things that children need. We still need encouragement. We still need support. We still need those things. And if we, as self-actualizing people, if we're going to give those things to people, then I think we also... if we're going to be self-actualizing people, I think it's important for us to create the kind of conditions where we can receive those kinds of things, because it's kind of like pushing a. I make the analogy of pushing a rock up a hill without a wheelbarrow. You can do it, but it's much easier if you have a wheelbarrow. And I realize that there are times when we're all alone in the wilderness and we don't have anybody else to support us. That's true, but I think one of the reasons we get into this will to fail is because a lot of times we don't have, people. We don't surround ourselves with people who are encouraging us on a regular basis to continue pursuing what it is we want to pursue, and I think we try to do it by ourselves, and then when we get into those inevitable moments when, you know, our animal nature kicks in and doesn't want to continue, I think it's really important myself to have support systems in your life at least it is for me, you know, to kind of gently encourage me to go out and go to the next level.
Oh, right. No question.
Yeah. So that's sort of my thoughts on the will to fail. So tell me, okay, let's go to the next part. I talked about taking responsibility for the inner life. What's that about?
Well, that inner, before we do that, talking about a little bit more about the will to fail, because it's so important. The other example I give is the one of... the guy that broke the speed barrier. Success is sometimes the chaos, and the hardest part is we're inches from victory and we give up. The guy that broke the speed record, I can't remember his name. Anyway, he had an airplane. It was the Bell X something. He took off one day, and he was going to try to break the speed record. Back then, they believed that if you hit a certain level of speed, the whole plane would disintegrate. It's like a wall. When you hit the sound barrier, the plane would just fall apart, and there was no way out of it. So you can imagine how scary that might have been. So he's flying this plane. He gets very close to the speed limit, and the plane starts to shake, as they usually do when they get there. Vibrate, and then the actual glass in the control panel broke. He kept it down, though. He kept going, and finally he broke through. and it was smooth as glass. And that moment was he got past that thing. So it was a design problem, always a design problem. It was never a real wall. And yet people, sometimes it was Chuck Yeager, sometimes people don't realize that they're at that moment of success and they give up. When if they keep the hammer down, they could succeed.
Well, our I think it was a 700 mile an hour barrier, right? Was
something
it was
like
a
that,
sound
yeah.
barrier? So are planes able to travel faster than that today?
Oh yeah. Okay,
I didn't know.
Several thousand miles an hour now.
Oh wow!
And once they get past that barrier, but they've learned how to see what would happen is the explosions of the sound would vibrate within the engine and before they got out. Then the boom is when they broke through when it got past that sound barrier. Then the sound left the engine and went into the atmosphere because he exceeded the speed of sound. That was that big noise that they would make.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about this world of fail though, because I think it's something. Again, I think it's I think another reason that this happens to us and it's inevitable. And I mentioned before is our animal. You know, we have what the Urantia book calls the human paradox. We have an animal nature and a spiritual nature. And the animal nature wants to, you know, wants to eat, sleep, and go to the bathroom, and that's all it wants to do. Or it wants to you know, fight or flight response. You know, it wants to protect itself, and it doesn't want to go out into uncharted waters. And I think that, you know, we need to. I think rather than calling ourselves lazy or calling other people lazy, I think we need to recognize that we have that animal nature and figure out some ways to kind of outsmart it a little bit, you know?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, remember Winston Churchill? He's always quoted as saying, never give in, never,
right,
never,
right.
Never. But the last part of that was he said, except to the convictions of honor and good sense.
Absolutely.
So you know, there is a point where you do, but most of us, we quit before that point's ever reached.
Yeah, I think part of the other problem, too, sometimes we try to do too much. I am in a position right now where I may be in a position where I'll be in a little better place financially. And when I do that, it's going to free me up to do what I really want to be doing. And so I'm going to have to decide, okay, what is it I really want to concentrate on? You know, I actually don't agree with people who say, maybe this is not a self-actualizing comment, but I don't agree with people who say, well, you know, you should do your best at everything you do. Well, I can't do my best at everything I do because some things are more important to me than others. So I got to decide what's important to me and what I want to focus on. You know, so that's I think that's where we get to decide. Well, maybe I should quit this and do this. You know, but as you said, it's got to be a conscious, objective decision. It can't be something we do just because we're discouraged.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that is, before we leave that is. Many people face, like I was talking about, facing a lecture or a challenge that's coming up. And the principle that I emphasize to people is this. Every battle, every struggle we have as it's approaching is won or lost before it ever takes place. And the reason that I say that is we decide whether we will win or lose way before it happens. And the state of mind we enter into that thing with determines it. And the example I give is one from boxing, Gene Tunney and Jack Dempsey. Now, Jack Dempsey was an invincible boxer back in the 20s. No one could beat him. And Gene Tunney came along and saw a flaw in him and decided he could beat him. And the flaw was that Dempsey, when he threw this devastating left hook, would lower his glove slightly. And Tunney saw that as an opportunity to throw a right. And he practiced this in his mind over and over again. Well, as the fight approached, Tunney would read the newspapers, and everybody picked Dempsey to win. It was like he became so afraid as he kept reading the newspapers. He couldn't believe how frightened he became, even though he thought he could win. And one night, his bed was shaking. He woke up, and it was him, fear. He was dreaming that Dempsey had punched him out and he'd lost. And he realized, and this is what happens to most people, that we replay failure in our minds too much. He decided that he would no longer read the papers. He'd write his own headlines in his mind. And he would never again read the papers. He'd read Shakespeare and things like that until the fight. And when the fight actually took place, he, when Dempsey entered the ring, just terrifying presence, he said, "Hi, hi, champ," and Disney was startled. And but when the fight started, early in the first round, Dempsey lowered that left, and Tunney, as he'd practiced in his mind over and over again, threw the right and jarred Dempsey. And from then on, he said the fight was his. That Dempsey was shaken and almost knocked out, and from then on. The reason I give that example is many people rehearse failure before these things happen. And if you keep in your mind that failure is impossible, praise God, that's the theme I use.
Well, it's ultimately impossible. That's true. I tend to like I guess it depends on your, it's a matter of perspective, because ultimately you're right. Failure is ultimately impossible.
Well, you know where I get that from?
From the Arantxa book.
No, right? Susan B. Anthony.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Susan B. Anthony fought for the rights of women. And, you know, of all the things that are, the most terrible thing this country's ever done is not allow women to vote. Even worse than the blacks, she struggled for women's suffrage when the Civil War started. And in 1900, or around 1905, she died. And her last words were to the people around her was, "Failure is impossible." It wasn't until 1920 that women got suffrage.
Wow.
But she knew that. She had a vision of that. So she, and many of us will live and die without knowing what good we did for the revelation or what good we did for the planet, and probably have done great good.
Wow.
So just to let you know, we've got four people on the line.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get to them. Okay. Let's I want to make sure. And I know that we couldn't cover your book, but I'd rather take calls because that's kind
of
the
fun. Oh, that's
fun.
That's fun. I love
that. Let's do that. Let's go to our first call. Who do we have for a start?
Okay. The first one is area code 301. Go ahead. You're on Cosmic Citizen.
301. You're on the air.
Okay. They just dropped off. I guess I scared them. Let's try the next one.
Pick up the phone.
Hello, area code 530. You're on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, 530. You're on the air. Wow, what's going on with these people?
Okay, well, we'll say goodbye to them. Okay, let's try.
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
Hello?
Wait a second. Larry, what's our next area code here?
We're now on area code 240. Hello?
That's me.
Cosmic Citizen.
That's me.
Who's me?
Hello. This is Vic. I'd like to ask Larry a question. I really enjoyed the program up to now. But what I am interested in is how this material that he deals with, specifically philosophical values of truth, beauty, and goodness, overlaid with the Maslowian pattern that he talked about, how that dovetails into his recent book, Metavalues, specifically how it overlays into integrity, excellence, and caring.
Oh, man, you've read the book, I can tell.
Oh, yeah, I have, yes.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, when I would talk to business people about truth, beauty, and goodness, their eyes would glaze over because how do you apply truth, beauty, and goodness to your life? This is a great question, Eric. And how do you apply it to your business? It's too hard to figure out. Well, the big problem with most people is when you ask them, and I asked the college course people this, I said, how many people here believe that my values are my values and your values are your values? And a couple in the back, a couple guys raised their hand that they believe that. Well, what I said is business people believe that too, and most of them say, yeah, I got my values, you got yours. Well, you going to tell me what my values are? I said, okay, well, I'm going to ask you this question, three questions. Would you hire anybody that lacked integrity, that you knew lied, that you knew you couldn't trust? No, I wouldn't hire anybody like that. Would you hire anybody that didn't care about their work? that they did sloppy work and they didn't care what kind of product. It had no excellence in the, no standard for, no, I wouldn't hire anybody like that. Would you hire anybody that didn't care for other people, that was rude, nasty, and caused problems within your company? No, I wouldn't hire anybody. These are the three values, truth, beauty, and goodness, and they convert. When you look at integrity, integrity is truth in action. So when you find integrity in person, you're seeing truth being manifested. When you see beauty in a person, or you see it manifested as excellence, when you don't need a sports writer to tell you just saw an incredible basketball shot, or you don't need a great chef to tell you just had a great meal. We have an intuitive respect for excellence when we see it, when we see excellence in people. And finally, caring, we respect goodness. We like to have people around us that are good people, that respect other people. So those are the three values we share. And I said, look, why isn't we share these? Why do we share these exact values? Why is it a Bush person in Africa, Bush person in Australia, why would they believe in truth, beauty, and goodness exactly as we do? Why does every single person honor truth, beauty, and goodness, normal-minded people? And this is exactly the way it translates into reality.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Vic, thanks for that question.
Okay.
Thank you, Rick.
I'm trying to sell your book.
Okay. All right, who's next here, Larry?
Well, we have three more callers. Let's go to, hello, area code 901. You're on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello. How are you all?
Good.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm just listening in. I'm at work with my phones on.
Okay.
Oh, good. Well, that's great.
Okay.
Okay.
You don't have a question?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Okay.
Thank you.
We'll just let you listen here. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Here's area code 301. Go ahead. You're a Cosmic Citizen.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. How's everybody? It's been a little while. I haven't been on. Yeah, I haven't been on, but I wanted to say hi. I actually had just something to share real quick before I do. I agree with what you're saying about self-actualizing people and all that. It all makes sense. It's actually true. So there's always differences of opinions and things like that, you know, little things, but that's just because we're people. But it all does make sense. And one of the things, especially with putting the situation in the other person's hands, you know, doing for the benefit of the other. And it helped me out with the one little thing that I came to share, which was that I do believe that I helped or am helping to convert an atheist. The last couple of days, I've been running around. First person I got into a discussion with, the Urantia book versus the Bible. He's a staunch a Christian, and, you know, the whole...
Tough one, yeah.
Right. So I would, I dealt with him, and we had a good conversation. Now, what happened in that conversation was, I do believe I won the argument. It's just, I don't think I went about it the right way. You know, I think I kind of made him mad, because at the end was like, well, that's why it's a religion. I said, yeah, that's why it's a religion and not an understanding. So he... that didn't work. But what happened, so he kind of is on the verge. And then I got an old Jewish guy that was a friend of mine. I got him to start listening to Jesus. I don't know if he actually believes, listening to what I'm reading him out of the Urantia book about Jesus. So he's kind of, pulling in. But this atheist girl, we stood for about 15, 20 minutes. And we just went back and forth, and she gave every reason in the book, or any reason she could come up with to try to disprove, and what ended up happening was I kept just debauching all her theories, just debauching one after another and after another. And I just said, at one point, I said, look, I have to stop. I said, this is not fair, because I remember what I did with the Christian guy. I said, this is not fair. I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it to you. You know, she didn't understand why. I said, man, I've debauched every single one of your theories. It's just not fair. Well, at that point, she became really interested. And, you know, she just kept going with it. So I didn't read her the book. I didn't have the book or anything. But she's got the name of the book. She was overly excited. By the time the night was over, she was all about going and, you know, reading it and being, she was all sorts of excited. So I just wanted to share that. And that one particular instance with putting it in the other person's hands, you know, just ironically seemed to be what happened. Is it wasn't until I told her, I just can't do it to you. I just can't sit here and just debauch you, you know, have a heated argument over it, because it's not, you know, it's something you're gonna have to find out. It's not something I can just tell you.
Hey, listen, wait. I want to ask you. Wait, Larry, hold on a second. This is Chris, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to let Larry know. Chris is a reader of the book who just discovered the book, and you're 25, right?
Correct.
That's awesome. Isn't that awesome? It's great. It's great when we find young new readers who are young readers. In fact, Larry, I just thought you, Chris, you're interested to know. Larry had when his kids were young, he had a study group with his daughter and I think some other people, you know, when they were teenagers and stuff, and they would sit around and eat pizza and they'd read the Arantxa book and everything. So I know that Larry's particularly, I'm sure that Larry's particularly interested in attracting young readers to the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they loved it. I mean, they finished the whole book. It took them almost 6 years, and then they wanted to start again. It was wonderful.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, Chris, you were talking about this. Oh, here's the interesting thing. You're talking about this atheist. Here's the interesting thing about that. It's kind of ironic you mentioned that, because Maslow claimed to be an atheist, but yet he was such a spiritual guy. And, you know, he talked about God in a sense without mentioning God. You know, he talked, and I think one of the things we can do, and don't you think this is true, Larry, when we talk to atheists, we can start talking about things. We don't even talk about God right away. We can talk about things that are not measurable. For example, we could say, well, things, well, I don't believe in God. You could say, well, you believe in love, don't you? You believe in truth. You believe in
truth. That's great. Yeah.
You can gently guide them toward this stuff without build on what they already know to be true. And that's a way of doing it, I think, without alienating an atheist, without you know, beating them over the head with anything.
That's interesting, because, you know, I met this guy from Romania before the wall came down years ago, and at a Urantia meeting, and the Christmas thing. And I was talking to him as a friendly guy, and I said, he said, no, I don't believe in it. He said, our society does not believe in God. We think it's okay that you do. It's all right. It's fine. If you want to believe in God, fine. I said, well, do you believe in truth? Well, of course we believe in truth. Well, do you believe in beauty? Yes, we have great artists. Well, do you believe in goodness? Yes, we have social programs. You believe in love? Yes, of course. I said, well, then you believe in my God. And he stopped them short.
Well, see, the thing I think is important about that is that you can't measure those things. You can't measure love. You can't measure truth. You can't put it under a microscope and analyze. Mm-hmm. And so, because a lot of these atheists will claim that they only believe in that which they can touch and see and feel, you know, and smell with their five senses. But the fact is, if what I'd like to ask an atheist is, okay, if you believe in truth and beauty and goodness, where do those things come from? If we're just a bunch of chemical reactions and biological or environment, you know, if we're just products of our heredity and environment, how can something that's purely biological or purely environment, how can it just a series of materialistic phenomena, how can that produce love and truth and beauty and goodness? It's got to come from a higher source.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Christopher Hitchens, who is such an atheist, and he wrote that book, How Religion Spoils Everything, God Is Not Great. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
And I used him for a good example, because when I started reading his book, I thought, oh, God, this is going to be painful. And it really was, except that I found something I didn't expect in the very beginning. And he said that the one Bible verse that he liked was he read to his father died at a funeral. He read this quote from the Bible, and he said, from Paul, and the quote's short, it's this: finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever so things are honest, whatever so things are just, whatever so things are pure, whatever so things are lovely, whatever so things are of good report, if they be of any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And I really thought, wow, that is cool. And then he said this, I chose this because of its haunting and elusive character, which will be with me till my last hour. For essentially, this was a secular injunction, and because it's shown out of the wasteland of rant and complaint and nonsense and bullying that surrounds it. And I said that I chose his quote for the same reason, because his book was bullying and ranting and raving. And it shows how values unify all good minds that are seeking, and maybe painfully without God, but seeking, that values are the one thing that we can all subscribe to.
Do you think a lot of people are seeking God, they don't even realize they're doing it?
Yeah, I do, especially atheists.
Yeah.
Because at least they know what they don't believe. It's better than an agnostic that don't know what they believe.
Yeah. Hey, Chris?
Uh-huh.
Chris, I wanted to just recommend a few things to you, a few books. Besides, I know you've read the Your Answer book, which is great. I want to recommend a few other books to you. First of all, Larry Mullins has his book. We can plug that, which is called The Meta Values Breakthrough. And by the way, how do people get that book if they want to get a copy?
Oh, it's on Amazon, and you can buy it at a bookstore. It's by a national publisher.
Right. And that's the thing that's also really interesting, Chris, is that Larry Mullins is a Your Answer book reader, and this is the first book that's ever been published where someone talks about Your Answer book concepts, but it's been published by a mainstream publisher. So that's really cool. And you even quote the Your Answer book once in the book, right?
Yeah, I did. I got a quote. I slipped one in. And it actually summarizes the whole book. It's a one-sentence quote from the Your Answer book that actually summarizes my whole book.
Oh, really? What's the quote?
Oh, gosh. Let me see if I can find it. Well, go ahead and talk a little bit, and I'll find
okay.
it.
Okay. The other thing, Chris, is I would recommend anything by Abraham Maslow, who is the psychologist that is primarily based on Maslow. One of his great books I really like is called The Farther Reaches of Human Nature. I read parts of that book when I was in college. I didn't finish reading the whole thing, but he's a really interesting guy. The other guy, and we haven't talked about him in this discussion, but another guy that I think is really interesting that I think, Chris, you really would find interesting to read is, have you ever looked into the writings of Carl Jung at all?
No.
Carl Jung. J-U-N-G. It's pronounced Jung. It looks like Jung when you read it, but he was a psychologist, but he was an incredibly interesting guy who believed in God and was just a fascinating person and had all kinds of interesting experiences. I would recommend his autobiography, which is called Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It's a great book. Really great
book. Good
book.
But, yeah, I got the quote.
Okay, go ahead. Shoot.
Okay, this is from the Urantia book. The eye of the material mind perceives a world of factual knowledge. The eye of the spiritualized intellect discerns a world of true values. These two views, synchronized and harmonized, reveal the world of reality, wherein wisdom interprets the phenomena of the universe in terms of progressive personal experience. That's a hard one to follow, but it kind of summarizes that science is the domain of what is, religion is the domain of what ought to be, philosophy is the domain of how to get from point A to point C, from what is to what ought to be. And that's what the whole book's about, your Rancho book.
Wow. Well, Chris, thanks for being with us here. I'm glad you're listening, and we're going to take another call here.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Who do we have next here, Larry?
Okay, here we have one from area code 530. Go ahead, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Yeah, I'm a new listener to this blog talk radio, and I've never called in before, but it's a really good conversation. My wife and I have read the Urantia book for a long, long time, and this is a great step forward, Larry, you know, to bring it to the mainstream like you are.
Well,
and I really compliment you on that, Larry.
I appreciate that so much. You can't know.
Hey, sir. No. Hey, what's your name, sir?
It's Jim.
What, I'm sorry?
Jim.
Hey, Jim, are you currently a Urantia book reader then?
Yes, I am.
How did you find out about our show?
I got an email from another reader. I think it was Vic sent me an email about it.
Oh, that's awesome. Where are you located, if you don't mind me asking? I never heard of this area code. Where is it?
I'm in Sacramento, California.
Wow.
Oh, okay, Sacramento.
There are three study groups going here pretty actively, and my wife and I have gone to local markets and tried to set up a little booth about, you know, letting people know what the Urantia book was, and I'd encourage all the listeners to get involved in some way, you know, to spread the news about the truth, beauty, and goodness that the Urantia book contains, because it really is a wonderful work, and the world needs to hear this message.
And how long have you been reading?
About 25 years.
Oh, okay. Okay, wow.
You're an old timer.
Yeah.
Thank God.
I'm looking forward to getting your book too, Larry. Thanks for all your help with that.
I appreciate that so much.
That's great. Okay, Larry, do we have any more calls, or are we?
We've exhausted the board for the time being.
From what?
There aren't any other calls right now.
Okay. Okay. Well, Larry, it's great. It's always great to hear from these listeners. I always want to make sure that our show is caller driven as much as possible, but I want to talk. I want to talk a little about taking responsibility for your inner life. That's another thing that self-actualizing people do. So talk a little bit more about that. What's that about?
Well, you know, this is where I was going to tell you about the resentments thing, how I got over my resentments, because I think most people carry so much baggage with them and just tough it out. We just struggle on with resentments because they keep popping up and we don't see any way of getting rid of them. And, you know, I went through an AA process and everything else, and I just couldn't do it. And I should tell this story while we still have a little time of how this all happened, how I came to believe in the Urantia book. I had it for about 5 years, and what happened was I carried it around. Clyde Bedell gave it to me, and then I lost a daughter in 1974 to drugs. That completely changed my life. Now, she changed gradually. She was the sweetest little gal, and she was 13 years old, as I said. She was never lied. She never did it. All of a sudden, she was dressing bizarrely, lying, doing different things. We just had no idea what was going on, and I discovered she was sniffing paint. So this was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was working at the time for a furniture store, and it was I was a very willful person at that time. I really was type A personality plus, and I thought I could handle everything and take care of it. And Vicky just, we couldn't handle, so I went to the psychiatrist, and he said, look, we'll put her in a milieu, an environment of love and appreciation, and we'll help her, and we'll keep her safe so she won't hurt herself and take sniff in secret. And so we took her to this hospital, a huge hospital in Tulsa, and on the emergency, it was an open ward, psychic ward, but it was open. And turned her over there, and I was also trying to get her into the children's hospital at the time. Well, what happened one night, this caused a break in the marriage, because I was very devoted to Vicky, and my wife was very devoted to our other daughter, and she suggested that we take the two daughters and go our separate ways. So we were separated at the time, but she called me one night and said there was trouble at the hospital. I drove her to the hospital, and we found out that Vicky was dead. The psychiatrist explained to us at the front of the ward that somehow she'd gotten a plastic bag and deodorant, and with another girl had gone in a room and spent a couple hours behind a closed door and sniffing, and it killed Vicky. Well, it was like a nightmare that you can't believe. Of all the things that have happened in my life, that was a 10. And everything else below that, from divorce, whatever you can think of, was a 5. It was the most devastating thing that had ever happened. Well, I didn't have a philosophy at the time to help me, so I decided I would read the Urantia book from beginning to end. I did it twice in a couple months, and I was convinced that when I got it closed, that I believe that this is the way it ought to be. Maybe this isn't the way it is, but it's the way it ought to be. And that's when I got active in the movement. And I carried with me, and we had a trial, by the way. We sued the hospital because it was very negligent that Vicky was given the plastic bag at the front desk and deodorant and was with a girl that was also in there for sniffing. But we sued and we failed. They had incredible lawyers, and it was just a total failure. Cost me a fortune. My first wife developed cancer through this whole process and died shortly after Vicky died. So it was a nightmare, and I carried hatred in my heart for the hospital, for the lawyers, for everything that had happened. But yet I still believed in the Urantia book, and I wrote stuff about the Urantia book. I wrote Jesus, God, and Man. I talked. I did all these things. But down deep in my heart, I still had that hate. And this went on for 12 years.
Hey, I hate to interrupt your story, but
yeah.
I just got to stop you for a second. Because,
sure.
Okay. Because this is an interactive show, so what you're saying is so important, Larry. Because now, this is not so bad anymore as it used to be. But I used to know a lot of people like that in the movement who just, if we're not careful, the Urantia book can get us on a head trip, where it just becomes an intellectual academic exercise.
Because
the book is so full of all this abstract philosophy. You know, we can miss the forest for the trees if we're not careful. Because I know people like that who, you know, I know one particular person I won't, you know, name, but some years ago, you know, he used to talk to me about all kinds of things about the Urantia book. We used to discuss all his philosophy, but he would snap at his wife, and he would, you know, and it's very, if we're not careful, what sometimes happens is people substitute the Urantia book for a relationship with God.
Oh.
The Urantia book becomes the thing that they worship. It becomes the thing that they, you know, and it becomes a strictly intellectual thing. And if we're not careful, this book can get into our heads. We need to get these principles down into our hearts.
Yeah, we'll have a religion about a book if we're not careful.
Right, exactly. So I'm glad you're being honest with us about that's where you were at that time. Would you say that you were applying the book to your intellect, but it hadn't sunk?
I didn't get it. You can't carry resentments and find God. You can, I mean, not completely. He may be trying to help you, but you got to get rid of him.
Right, but what I'm asking is, do you think the book was kind of, you were only getting kind of half the...
Yeah, that's exactly. I think you hit it right on the head.
Okay. So go ahead. So what happened?
Oh, so anyway, I got married again shortly after, probably sooner than I should have. And 11 years go by. Now, just picture 11 years having gone by from... Well, I'd moved to Oklahoma City. And then suddenly the second marriage ended. The woman wanted a divorce. So I decided I would... What I actually went into was AA, and the reason was not exactly that I wanted to do that as much as I was looking for a girlfriend and went to AA, and she told me that if I would join AA, I could have a relationship with her. So,
wait, were you a recovering alcoholic?
No, I was kind of like a high bottomer, I think. And I haven't drank anything since, and it's been almost 25 years, so... But I think I did better without alcohol. I was not really one of a slithering drunk or anything, but I liked the booze. But the big thing was I wanted a relationship with this woman, and that was why I went into it. But I got fascinated by the spiritual program there, and one of them is of resentments. And when I got to the part where I wrote down my resentments, I couldn't believe all the hate I had inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
As a Urantian, how could I hate so much? So then the next thing, they have a fifth step where you talk to someone and they get rid of these resentments for you. And this I thought would be impossible. So I said, look, I don't want to talk to anybody in Oklahoma City that knows me. I want to talk to somebody that doesn't know me. So they looked around. They found somebody in Tulsa, back in Tulsa, that didn't know my name and didn't know much about me. So they said, go there and meet with this guy, and he'll help you. He's a fifth step black belt. So I drove into Tulsa and go by that big hospital where a big pink building. Every time I went by it when I lived there, I said, that's where they killed Vicky. And I'd feel this anger. And I thought, God, why am I here? Why did I come? Anyway, I meet this guy and he drives me to his house. And we sit down and he puts coffee. And we're, okay, he's going to help me here. I said, look, I'm going to tell you something before we start that I got a resentment that even God can't get rid of. And I explained the story of Vicky. And as I talked, this guy got white. And he just listened and I thought, man, they are worse than this. This isn't a big deal. And when I got done, here's what he said. And this is exactly what he said. He said, Larry, there's no place on earth you should be but here today. And there's no one you should be talking to but me. And I said, why? He said, because... I was one of the doctors on the Blue Code Blue team that tried to save Vicky's life.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, I didn't remember the name, but now I do. He said, You had a trial. I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to tell you that we tried to save her. We did so much. We worked so hard. He said, I held her in my arms, Larry. And then her heart went into fibrillation, and we just lost her. I was so devastated that I went to the library the next day and see if we'd missed anything. I said, Larry, we didn't. It just happened. It was so unfortunate. I felt so bad about it. Well, I didn't know what to say. And we'd sit there, and we held hands for,
wow.
We said nothing for hours. I just didn't know how long we sat there. And then I got up and left. And, you know, this guy, his name is Ted Winger, and he's mentioned in the book, and we still talk. He's still a wonderful man. He's pretty old now, but it was so incredible. And he said it changed his life as well because he was doubting God, and he was doubting.
Oh, you got him into your – you told him your answer book?
No, not in your answer book, but in AA he'd come convinced that God wasn't really real there. And mm-hmm. He said, this changed his mind completely. So that experience, but, you know, there's a saying in the East, before enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water. After enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water. That's it. It was a fabulous experience, and it was a peak experience. Now, here's what happened when I left. I drove out of Tulsa, went by that building, and it was illuminated, and the sun was going down. It was like golden. It looked different. And I felt in my mind these words. It said, my son, don't tell me what I can or cannot do. And it was as though all of this hatred was gone.
Yeah, and it never came back.
And
that's amazing. You know, I got to tell you, though, well, a couple things. First of all, this reminds me of a show we did a few weeks back with a lady named Jennifer Skiff, who wrote a book called God Stories. This is obviously a God story for you. I mean, this is, you talk about something where you know, God did something for you that you couldn't do for yourself. And that's what you talked about. You talk about being lifted, not lifting ourselves
up. Exactly,
being lifted.
That's right.
And that's really it. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, what more proof do you need that there's a God, you know? That's just amazing. That is absolutely amazing. But, you know, but I want to talk about this because, Larry, most of us don't have that. That was a pretty dramatic experience.
Well,
most
let me tell you, though, it here's the thing about that. It was wonderful, but it started to fade away, and I couldn't bring it back. It was like that moment was so wonderful, but I still had to. You still have to do the grunt work.
No, I realize that, but what I'm saying is most people don't even have what you're talking about.
I know.
They don't even have that. So what I'm saying is let's talk to the person who – it's one thing, again, as you know, I'm interested in how to change, not just telling people to change. So how do you do this? How do you work on overcoming resentment?
Well,
I've got some techniques myself, but I'd like to hear your answer.
Well, as I tried everything. I tried all the AA thing. I tried every book and everything else and couldn't do it.
No,
so
talk to the person out there. How do they do it? I mean, if you ask, how does the average person who has not had the kind of peak experience you just described, okay, if they're just struggling day by day, trying to overcome a result, Do you think a lot of it just comes down to just saying, God, I can't do it, you do it?
Yeah, I do. But I think we have to work real hard before we reach that point. I think
I agree.
God realized that I was a lost soul. I wouldn't get past this thing. It's kind of interesting that Maslow, when he started studying people, looking for self-actualizers, he said he assumed that everybody had these feelings of unwarranted guilt and shame. That's something everybody just had. Most psychologists believe that. And he said, but when he found a self-actualizer, they weren't there. Now, why weren't they there? Because I believe, personally, that God's there. And these you can't carry these resentments and hatred and progress. It's just...
Well, I do think that we have them to one degree or another, at least for a time.
Yeah,
you know?
I think
those people probably had them at one point.
Yeah. But the thing, and people would tell me, and it was well intended. They would say, Larry, look, you're justified in feeling angry at the house. It's just not true, because you jump off a building. There's a law of gravity. You hit the ground, and that's the way resentments are. And Jesus made it very plain that you will be forgiven totally once you forgive others, but you can't receive that forgiveness. You're forgiven now, but you can't receive it until you forgive others.
Yes.
You couldn't.
Well, and you know, Well, yeah, and I think there's also a flip side to that, too, which is we can't forgive others until we receive...
Andre and Larry, I've opened Ann Garner's mic. She's on the line as well.
Oh, sure. Let's give her the...
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Larry. Hi,
good to
Andre.
Hear your voice.
Oh, Larry, I'm telling you, you did it. This book is awesome.
Oh, well, thank you, Ann.
I'm telling you, and I apologize, I haven't emailed you back yet. I'm blown away. You did it. Thank you, Ann. And this morning I was reading it to my husband, and I want to read a paragraph that really, in fact, I'm going to quote him. He said, from what you've read already, this book needs to be on everybody's bookshelf. He said, don't get one from them, get a case.
Oh, sweet. That's nice.
Yeah, because I kept trying to decide who I was going to give that other book to.
Uh-huh.
And then my list got longer and longer and longer, and I was reading it yesterday to a group and some interfaith folks. And just like the Urench book, when I would directly quote something you had written, you know what I would hear? Wow, that's true.
That's sweet, Ann. I appreciate that.
Tell me what the paragraph is.
Okay,
Ann,
here it is. It's on page 27 of this masterfully written book. There's an interesting side effect of the actualizer's commitment to a mission they believe has supreme importance. This person is aware of the evil and chaos in the world, but is less acutely disturbed by it than most people are. Actualizers are doing all they can within their spheres of influence. Therefore, they're not wringing their hands. They're taking action, attempting to make things better. Thank you, Larry.
Oh, thank you, Ann. That's great. Appreciate that.
So we're going to actualize that many, many books will be sold.
Well, thank you so much, Ann. I appreciate this call. I can't tell you how much.
And I have fond memories of us sitting together actualizing those study guides. Thank
you. Oh, you bet. Me too.
I'm revising some of them, so get ready. I may ask you to do some more drawings.
I will do it. I will gladly do it.
And Andre, thank you for inviting Larry today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
And Larry, we're all coming to visit you because of where you live now.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. It's a great. I love St. Augustine. It's so beautiful.
Oh,
it is
yeah.
So beautiful.
Well, I'll let you gentlemen get back to the interactions, and I'm going to get back into the chat room. I always enjoy that.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for calling in, as
Thank
always.
Thank you, Ann.
I love you immensely, Larry.
Love you too, dear.
Bye. Bye, Andre.
Bye, Ann. Okay.
She's a great lady, isn't
she? She is a great lady. I'm glad we're having all these calls today. It varies, you know, on our show. Sometimes we get a lot of calls, sometimes we get a few. So that's a testament to your popularity here, Larry. Let's talk about going back to this resentment thing, because I think at one point, so someone has to at some point say, you know what, I can't do this on my own anymore. You know, God has to do it. And as you said, we have to do a lot of hard work before we get to that point. But do you think that's really pretty much the solution ultimately to healing these resentments is get to a place where you realize that only God can do it?
I think we have to show up and cooperate, and God can't do it without our mm-hmm. Cooperation. But yeah, I think God can do it. The real difficult ones, yeah, God has to heal it, and we just have to yield to His presence and let Him do it.
Yeah, yeah. I think to me, one of the things that helps me, and I know this is no substitute for the God thing. Okay. But there are some techniques that I find help for me. One of the things I mentioned to you, I've talked about this on the air before. I won't rehash the story about, talking about my difficulties with my mother. But one of the things that I've realized is that one of the reasons I've struggled with so much resentment for my mom is because I love her and care about her. And, you know, if I didn't care about her and I didn't love her, she would not be able to have an effect on me. And so I think that's when I remember that, I think that helps. You know, it helps. It doesn't justify the resentment. What it does is it's rather than trying to fight it and say, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this way. You know, I try to understand what the feelings are about.
Mm.
You know, and I think even in your own case, I mean, you, I know you didn't love and you didn't love those psychiatrists and those doctors probably, but underneath that resentment was an intense devotion to your daughter. There was love there. I'm not saying the resentment is okay. What I'm saying though is, if you didn't love your daughter, if you know, you wouldn't have felt that way.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think it's important for us to remember that, because I think it's and I'm not trying to let ourselves off the hook, but I think we need to always try to see the goodness in ourselves if we can.
Oh, absolutely, no question.
You know, so that's wow, that's awesome.
Well, the goodness in ourselves is God. That's where it comes.
Yes.
From.
Yes, but Jesus always, I think Jesus always saw the good in people. I can imagine Jesus saying to you, Larry, you know, saying that very thing to you, saying, Larry, you know what? It's because you love your daughter so much. That's why you're having this struggle.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I always think about that, and I used to think that if Jesus was in the next room, I'd be afraid to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would, you know what I mean? You just feel... God, to stand next to Jesus, what would that be like? And the funniest thing, and it wasn't funny, but it was a strange experience I had when I was a young man. I was about 18, and I was just a real terror. And I had a hangover. I was laying on my bed, and we lived in a very shabby place. And I had motorcycle boots on and a T-shirt and stuff. And my mother yelled and said, Larry, the plumber's here. Well, we were renting. And the plumber was there to fix some pipes, and I got up cussing. I remember just cursing like mad because I didn't want to bother with it. When I opened the door, he's standing there, and he's a little teeny guy, and he's looking at me, and you can imagine how intimidating that might have been for him. And he's beaming with this wonderful smile, and he looked at me in such a way that I could imagine Jesus would do. It completely took my heart by surprise. And I swear, I never forgot it. To this day, I think about it. I think that this man somehow had that presence that Jesus would, to some degree. And really, I never forgot that moment, that somebody looked at me as though I was a human being and was loved. And he was unintimidated by the appearance I tried to make to scare people.
Wow. Wow. Well, by the way, there's something that's off the subject, but it's related to our overall subject, which is that you talk about being needs, Larry. And, you know, what that reminds me of is what John Bradshaw used to say, that we're human beings, not human doings. And I thought that was just great, because I think that some people can misunderstand the whole self-actualizing thing. I think that they think it's about, you know, I've got to do more. I've got to achieve this. I've got to do it. And it's really not about that. It's about being a certain kind of person.
It's unfolding, and it's a wonderful thing. None of us really know what's going on, but it happens unconsciously when we're doing something else. When we're serving,
absolutely.
Probably, when we serve, it's probably the greatest force and power for communicating with our thought adjuster that we have.
Yeah.
And that's when it happens.
Well, look at what's going on with this show. I mean, it's just flowing, and people are calling, and, you know, it's the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so taking responsibility. Now, I want to say, talk about taking responsibility for our inner lives. Now, I had come to, this is just sort of a side note that I want to kind of plug here, because it's something else that I think I'm going to use in my coaching practice. Somebody said something to me a while ago, and again, I'm all on board with you about overcoming resentments. To me, it's a question of how. And somebody said something to me a long time ago. We were talking about choosing a marriage partner, and he said, you can't help how you feel. And, you know, I thought about that, and I really agree with that, but I started to realize how profound that statement really is. Because I don't think we are. You talk about taking responsibility for the inner life, and I agree with that. But I don't think we're responsible for our feelings or even our thoughts, because a lot of times we can't control how we feel. We can't even control what thoughts come into our mind. But we can control, what we choose to dwell on and what we choose to let into our minds. So, I think that's where our responsibility comes in. But I find for me though, when I'm feeling something, you know, feeling a negative feeling, the best thing for me to do is just let myself feel it and then let it go. You know, rather than trying to fight it. But anyway, that's kind of a side note. But I think that what else do you, besides the overcoming resentments, what else do you mean when you talk about taking responsibility for our inner lives?
This is interesting you say that, because, something else happened to me when I was about 18, besides my first peak experience, which was I could never explain, never know why it happened. But I was getting a haircut from this barber that I'd never been in before. He's a cripple guy. And he started talking about consciousness and stuff that I had no, I didn't know what he was talking about.
When you were 18 years old?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had no idea what he was talking about. And he just seemed to talk about God and things like that. And I got done, and he said, look, read this book. And he hands this book to me. It's called Raja Yoga. It's about mind control, self-development. And it was, I believe it came out pre-1900. And it's still in print, by the way, Raja Yoga. It's interesting. But anyway, I said, oh, look, you don't believe all this crap. You don't really believe it, do you? And he said, well, just take it like a cafeteria, and if you like it, take what you like and leave the rest. I took it home, and as I said, we live in a very poor home. It just really run down. I was sitting in my room, and I was reading by the light by the window, and I've found something I didn't expect at all. It was the fact that we can control our inner life. We can control what we think. Now, you said we get false things. That's true, but they believe that you could dispel an unpleasant thought like you should be able to, like you could take a stone out of your shoe. But anyway, what fascinated me was I'd never heard of such a thing, and also that there was another way to live. That there was another way to live, not later, but now, at this moment. And that was in the inner life. And I remember looking up from the book, and it was almost getting dark by then, and I thought, this is really fascinating. There is another way to live. That stuck with me, too, for the rest of my life.
Yeah. I wouldn't go so far as to say that we can take an unpleasant thought like the way we have a stone out of our shoe. Well, maybe we can, but we can't. But we can't control.
No, it said that we should be able to.
Oh, well, maybe we should. But I let me put it this way. I guess I like to deal in reality for one thing. But I guess what I'm getting at is we can't keep the stone from getting into our shoe in the first place. Yeah, maybe we can take it out once it's there. But I do believe that in the long term our inner life is within our control. But there are things about it that are not completely within our control.
It's a tussle. It's a real tussle. I mean, it's nothing that you can solve today and it's all done. I mean, that battle has to be fought over and over and over.
And it's also a process because, you know, there are feelings I used to feel years ago that I don't feel now, you know, and think so. But it's not going to happen because I try to turn them off. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think you can turn your feelings off like switches.
You read Emmett Fox, I'm sure. He said that this is a very blessed state when you're in turmoil with your inner life.
Who said that?
Yeah, he said that because...
Wait, no, who said that?
Emmett Fox.
Oh, okay, okay.
The Sermon on the Mount. He said that, look, when we're hated and reviled, we do it to ourselves. This is a very blessed state because we're dealing with our lower self and trying to raise above it.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And the Urantia book, that's what the Urantia book says, is there can be no growth without psychic conflict and spiritual agitation.
Absolutely, I'm sure.
So, yeah, I absolutely agree with you there. Larry, how are we doing on time here?
We have 26 minutes.
Okay.
We have Crystal on the line.
Okay.
Okay, let's do this.
It's Crystal.
Hi, Crystal.
I don't think...
Larry.
Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good.
The comment that I wanted to make has sort of, you've already just made it, basically. So I don't really have anything to add.
Oh.
So I'll just...
Okay.
Thanks for calling anyway.
You just, you know, took my line. But I just wanted to say I really have appreciated your being on the show today and talking
to
us about this fabulous book.
Yeah, well, bless your heart. I appreciate that a lot. It's good to hear your voice.
You too. Take care.
Thanks, Christy.
Yeah.
Bye.
Okay, Larry, do we have any more calls right now?
Well, we have a 530.
Another 530. Must be another Sacramento person.
530, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, Sacramento, are you with us? Maybe that's the same guy calling back.
Wow.
Jim. Maybe he wants to listen. I don't know. Or something may have happened. I don't know.
Well.
Okay. Is that it?
Long 530, and that's it.
Okay. Wow. So tell me. Okay. So taking responsibility. So we got taking responsibility for the inner life. What's the last thing too that self actualizers do? There was a third thing that we were going to talk
about.
Well,
there's three things. We'll just go over them again. They need an impregnable self respect.
Okay.
That's so critical and so important. And one of the things that I emphasize in the book is about respect. And, you know, for something that's free, that doesn't cost anything, it's become a rare commodity, and we deal it out very frugally to other people. Jesus was like, gave it with ungoverned generosity to every soul he met, and we want to emulate Jesus. That's something we should remember. This is another kind of experience I had early in life in Oklahoma, and I was in this fair, this county fair, and I was watching the people go by, and there were people with, you know, tattoos and overweight and different ugly people and doing all these things to be noticed and stuff, and I thought, how will I ever learn to love humanity? I don't even like these people going by. And suddenly it occurred to me, okay, you don't love them, but you can respect them. Try to respect them as they go by. So what I started doing was looking at people with respect, understanding that what they were trying to do was be loved, even though they were doing it at a time when they should have learned to love instead of trying to be loved, that unpleasant possible that present aspect of it, but they were trying to be loved. So I looked at it, people with respect, and there was like an incredible transformation. People would look at me, and suddenly they would see this glint, which they would change as they went by. They would sometimes smile. They would act differently, and it elevated me, and it made me feel great and wonderful. And I started realizing what respect can do.
That's really funny you should say that, Larry, because I have kind of the opposite experience right now. I do everything in my power, and, you know, hopefully with God's power, to love everybody. But respecting, I don't respect everybody. I have to admit, there are some people I've lost respect for. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I actually don't think we're commanded to respect everybody. But I guess what I'm saying is, whatever gets you to a place though, where you can love one more person each day or each week, as the Answer Book puts it, and if respect gets you there, that's great. I have. Finding though that there are some people that I try to love, but I'm not at a place where I can respect them yet.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's interesting. If you can love them and not respect, that's good. I think that's great. Remember Jesus with the guy that was had this boss he hated. Jesus told him if he was drowning in the sea, he would try to save him, and maybe that was what he should be doing, is trying to save this poor person. What interesting line I got from a book, it wasn't in the Ranch book, but it said that every unpleasant thing a person does that we find repelled by is usually because they're striving to be loved at a time when they should long ago have learned to be striving to love others.
Well, it's kind of like that thing, Paula read this quote, I think it was last week from the Ranch book, which is the greater the love need in any creature, the more divine love to seek to fill that need. And it also says in the same place, in that same paragraph, I think it says that the less love there is in a creature, the greater the love need.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah.
And that's not to say there aren't broken vessels that there's wiring missing that we need to protect ourselves against. I mean, that Jesus even acknowledged that.
Sure. But I think that's generally true, that the less love there is in someone, the more the love need is there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's wow. So okay, so impregnable self. So what does that talk about? What that means, impregnable self-respect, and what kind of?
Well, you know, the example I give is Marva Collins was a teacher.
Yes, I know who she is.
Yeah, she African American teacher in Detroit, and she.
I think she was in Chicago.
Oh, maybe so.
Yeah, on the South Side, I think. She had a private school.
Okay, what's it? Move it to Chicago then. I'm going from memory. It was a senior moment here. She was an extraordinary person. She was a teacher in the schools there, and it was a terrible place to be a teacher. So she decided that she would start her own school, and she started a school for people that were kicked out of the regular school, so you can imagine the quality of kids she was getting. Well, one day, she became very famous, by the way, for the kids being so wonderful and educated, but one day, early on in this thing, she had a girl show up at the door that looked overweight, sloppy. She was not coming out of her nose, sipping it. I mean, she's like something really out of very needed to be fixed. And she had been dressed up, but she was she just was terrible. So the kids started giggling, and Marva Collins made them keep quiet. Well, this little girl didn't seem to pay attention to anything. She would slide on the floor. She'd do all kinds of terrible things. This went on for quite a while. And then one day she jumped up and ran out the door in the freezing cold, and Marva chased her out and tried to hug her. Now, Marva Collins' philosophy was that respect could heal anything. And she said, "I hug these children till their eyes start to dance, and then I teach them." Well, she hugged this girl, and this girl said, "I can do anything I want. My mommy says I can do anything I want." And Marva Collins realized that maybe this wasn't working because she had taken the wrong tactic, that there's no, cure-all for everything. So when they returned into the classroom, she gave her a page that they were supposed to fill out, and she said she didn't want to do it. She wouldn't do it. So Marva Collins got so angry at her, she picked up this tube been there from the cleaners, from the vacuum cleaner, and held it in her hand and said, "Either you fill that page out or I'm going to kill you." And then she realized, my God, what have I said? She'd never hurt a child in her life. She'd never done anything like that. And all the kids were staring at her, and she thought, oh, my God, now what do I do? What do I do if she won't fill it out? Well, the little girl started to fill it out slowly, synonyms, and she was hitting everyone exactly right. And Marva Collins realized that she had been listening all the time. This little girl became one of their star pupils, and eventually she wrote about, if Frederick Douglass can do it, I can do it too. She wrote this wonderful thing for Afro-Americans, and it was she just became a fabulous person.
Wow.
And this was done by respect. This is what the magic of respect, and this is what Jesus had with him. He restored human beings because he acknowledged their highest potentials and, beauty.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. So, yeah, but how did she respect her? How did Marva Collins respect this girl by telling her she was going to kill her?
Well, what the thing that I found fascinating by that was not so much the respect thing, but the very fact that she did respect her, but also the very fact that all tactics don't work on all people.
Right.
That God
right.
will guide you to what to do, and I think God directed her to pick up that pipe.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if we should be encouraging that kind of behavior.
Yeah, no, you can't. You can't encourage it because, it was, who could have thought of such a thing?
Yeah, yeah. Larry, did you say that we had another call?
Could elaborate more on the differences between respect and love.
I'm sorry?
We have a request if you would please elaborate more on
the differences between respect and love. Okay.
Love.
Well, that's kind of a tough one. I respect means literally to look again, to re-look, to take another look. And I think when we take another look at people, we start to find something to love. Respect is probably the beginning of love, and that's how I would judge it. How would you, Andre?
Well, I think that there's a couple things to say about that. One is a couple things I think about when I think of respect. One is I try to look at people as innocent until proven guilty. And once they've been proven, if someone's been proven guilty, then I feel like I'm justified in losing a certain amount of respect for them. But I think you can still love someone without respecting them. Now, can you respect them without loving them? That's an interesting one. I don't know. But I think that the other thing, I think there are two different kinds of respect, though. Because I remember having an argument with my mom about this very thing. Because I accused her of not respecting me at one point. But, there's two kinds of respect to me. One is the kind that's earned. Like if you respect someone because they're good at what they do, or and so you respect that. There's another. There's a deeper kind of respect though that I think is even more is even more profound, and that's respecting the dignity of each person because they're created in the image and likeness of God. You know, it's an intrinsic respect. To me, one of the things that means is that you don't patronize people. You know, you let people make decisions even if you don't agree with them. You assume that they know what's best for themselves. Now, I realize that that's not always true. There are times when someone really doesn't know what's best for themselves. And so maybe there's a time when it's okay to be patronizing. I don't know. But I think one of the things, you know, we talked about this in the Urantia book. It says that God stands back in merciful respect and lets people make their decisions. And I think that's part of what respect comes down to is, you know, letting people make decisions, even if you disagree with them, and not trying to interfere. You know, now if someone asks you to intervene and asks you for advice, I think that's a whole different thing. But those are just some initial thoughts that I have.
Yeah, I think that's good. You know, it was a transformation. The thing that fascinated me was the transformation that it showed the power of relationship. That what took place in Oklahoma that afternoon was the fact that I changed the part of the relationship I had control over, and that changed the relationship completely. And that's the key to all relationships, I think, is to be able to change your side of it.
Yeah.
And that love, respect, the alchemy, I think, is you can experience it in the supermarket, shopping mall, any crowded place that you see people, and try it. It's some experiment I think people should try. Once you've tried it, you'll see it different, because usually we close the shades inside as we walk around in the supermarket. We just don't look at people and smile. And, you know, Jesus said that, I mean, the book says that Jesus would restore people by a simple smile as he went by.
Wow.
And I think Albert Schweitzer said that our second job, if we're on wherever we are and we see somebody and we smile, we could save a person from committing suicide by one smile.
Yeah, I believe that. I absolutely believe that that's true. It's the small things that really matter.
Yeah.
You know, Mother Teresa talks about that. You know, we can't do any great things. They only do small things with great love. So
I love
that. Really right on.
I love that.
Yeah. So how does this stuff that we're talking about, self-actualization, all this, how does this, I mean, we talked to touch on this a little bit, but how does this relate to the Urantia book?
Well, you know, I think the Urantia book is the ultimate document, and I think all of us have a little piece of it that we get, and I think I got a little piece of the Kingdom of Heaven paper that really fascinated me and I was able to get into deeply. But I think everybody has a little piece of that they need to bring to the world, that they love, and they find a part of the book that absolutely entrances them. That's my own opinion. The actualization of that mission to bring that to the world. Our mission, Joan and I, we decided long ago, was not to sell books, but to bring our message, get our message out, or the message we perceive to be in the book out. And that's never failed us. Going to the Flagler College, The young people today are somewhat different than they were in Maslow's day. Maslow used to say to them, which of you will be the great teacher, the great leader, the great politician, great artist of the future? And he said that the kids then would shuffle their feet and look at the ground and stuff like that. And then he would say, if not you, then who? And when I told that story at Flagler College, and I said the same words that Maslow. I said, this is what Maslow said. But when I got to that point, when I said that, which of you, they were all staring at me. They were all wide-eyed and saying, it's me, it's me.
That's really interesting you say that, Larry, because one of the things that I hear a lot of people complain about, and it really drives me crazy when they complain about it, because I think they sound like a bunch of cranks. They complain about these young people. They have too much self-esteem these days. They think too highly of themselves. Well, you know what? What's wrong with that? I mean, I'm not saying they should. Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it is theoretically possible to have too much self-esteem, but I think it's more of a good thing than a bad thing. And I think it's great that these kids are, you know. Now, some people would argue that their expectations are too high, but you know what? Why should we be killing their idealism at that age? I don't see how that's a good thing. I think we should be encouraging that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, in fact, that's interesting. There's a Chinese saying that not to worry if that you'll go too high because the spirit will pull you back to earth. Not to worry that you go too low because the spirit will lift you.
That is excellent. I love that. Is that from the Tao, you said?
It's from a book called Shambhala.
Oh, interesting.
It was a very fascinating book. It's interesting.
That's fascinating. Wow. That's amazing. That's really great. Wow. So, okay, so go ahead. You were going back to the, we were, I was asking again how this relates to the Urantia book.
Well, you know, what I did was take the five principles of the kingdom, which I think are extremely important, the preeminence of the individual, which we talked about, you know, that impregnable self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is the will as the determining factor in human experience. Well, that's when we were talking about the Jonah complex and the fact that the inner life is our responsibility, our real experience we create within. The outer experience we can't do much about, but the inner experience we're completely responsible for. Now, those two areas are the first two principles that Jesus said. And then he went to the third thing, which was the spiritual fellowship with God the Father. I think that's when we get into the self-actualizing process, and I think that's the third circle. I think when we get that far, we're in the third circle when we're in spiritual, like a team with the Father, that we are teaming up with the Father to achieve some mission. And then the fourth thing, fourth principle of the kingdom that mentions that is the supreme satisfactions of loving service. Though that, I believe, is when we get into the full aspects of self-actualization and the joy of serving. And finally, it says the transcendency of the spiritual over the material and human personality. Human personality is emerging, and the spiritual part of it is constantly will excel over the material part. So we're always evolving. But the one quote, I'll just read a little. At the end, it said, a little paragraph, it said, about these five principles. You know, I talk to your answer groups, and I'll say, well, now let's all talk about the five principles of the kingdom of heaven. Who knows the first one? Well, no one ever knows the first one. No one ever knows what I'm talking about. So I think that paper should be revisited because that is where the midwares did a great deal of prophecy.
Well, yeah, I actually found their prophecy to be a little vague, but maybe need to kind of read between the lines a little bit. I don't know. Maybe that paper is worthy of some intense study.
Let me tell you. Read this paragraph first, though. The world has never seriously, nor sincerely, or honestly tried out these dynamic ideals and divine ideals of Jesus' doctrine of the kingdom of heaven. But you should not become discouraged by the apparently slow progress of the kingdom idea on your Urantia. Remember that the order of progressive evolution is subject to sudden and unexpected periodical changes in both the material and spiritual worlds. The bestowal of Jesus as an incarnated son was just such a strange and unexpected event in the spiritual life of the world.
Wow.
Neither make the fatal mistake of looking for the age of manifestation of the kingdom and failing to its establishment in your own souls.
Yeah, yeah.
That to me was really.
What paper is that, by the way? Is it paper what?
Kingdom of Heaven paper. You know, I don't know what paper it is, but it is.
I know what paper it is. It's called the Kingdom of Heaven. I understand that.
Yeah.
And by the way, one of the things I think is really is important is that we make when we share the gospel that we make the Kingdom of Heaven the central, or the family really is what Jesus was trying to, you know, the family of God. That we make that the central message that we share, because, you know, unfortunately for most Christians, the gospel has become, you know, the atonement doctrine instead of the kingdom. And so, you know, I just think that's
yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, because the epic we're in now, if you read that paper carefully, is not the epic of brotherhood, because we're not ready for that yet. It's the epic of individual development, that when we develop people, leaders who are willing to make the sacrifices to step up and take the world away from, you know, the world's been run by Homo sapiens males for so long and drenched in innocent blood and torture and exploitation.
Yeah.
We need more leaders, Urantian thinkers that think in truth, beauty, and goodness to step up and take the reins of this thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. So
another quote, just a quick one.
Sure.
By teaching that the kingdom is within, by exalting the individual, Jesus struck the death blow to the old society in that he ushered in a new dispensation of true social righteousness. So he recognized that, you know, they had a big thing about community back then. You always help the community. You always never violate the community.
Right.
And Jesus said, no, wait a minute, start thinking for yourself. Start emerging.
Yes, yes.
The kingdom of heaven is within.
Yes.
Boy, that was revolutionary.
Well, it's funny because, you know, there are a lot of thinkers who think we're too individualistic in our society. But see, I don't see a dichotomy here between the individual and the community. I think what we, like you said, we need to, before we get into the era of brotherhood, we need to get into the era of individual self-development. Because what we need is we need to create communities that foster the individual. So we need, because I agree, we can't, I don't believe we're supposed to be rugged individualists and exist without community. We need community, but at the risk of sounding self-centered here, the community exists for the individual. The individual does not exist for the community.
Right. I think that's
true. And so the community needs to be there as a tool to nourish and cultivate, the individual.
Yeah, and when the individual perceives something that ought to be, what ought to be must be, because what ought to be is God's will. And when they perceive something that has their name on it, that's the most blessed thing they can find.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think maybe another way of putting it is that and Jung talks about this a lot. You know, I mentioned Jung before, and I don't know if I haven't finished reading your book. I don't know if you quote Jung in your book at all, but do you think there's a parallel between what Jung talks about, what Maslow talks about, self-actualization, and Jung's concept of individuation?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think they all had their finger on a lot of it, and, you know, Maslow thought that values were biological in origins instead of spiritual, but I think they all had their finger on certain truths.
Yeah.
And you know, it's gradually filtering too, but the Urantia book has the whole thing just laid out for us in such beauty.
Sure. Well, of course, Jung, you know, he was, I'll have to put in a plug for him. You know, before he died, he was interviewed on the BBC, and they asked him, do you believe in God? And he said, I don't believe, I know.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, isn't that great? But yeah, it's interesting because I think what you were talking about, what was going on in Jesus' day, was what Jung would call collective values. Everything was about the tribe, the collective.
Yeah, I know he did, and that's why I shied away from comment.
Yeah, and that's what, I think community is great, but I think collective and tribe is what we need to, you know, we need to get away from. But another guy who really understood this whole concept of community and understood rightly understood it was M. Scott Peck, who died a few years
ago.
Yeah,
wonderful.
He wrote a book called The Different Drum, which is a fantastic book.
I love that book, yeah.
Really, really talks about how, you know, the importance of this stuff. So,
what we need is voices. We need the voice of each individual that hears this. That voice needs to be heard because they have a precious, wonderful gift to give, and they have to believe that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's like a symphony, you know, and everybody's part.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, that was Saskia's famous phrase, it's like a symphony.
Yeah, and, you know, the race orchestra thing. The other thing I think is interesting is, you know, to me, this is why I love the whole fact of the fact of the family of God, that it's not like in a lot of Eastern religions, you know, the book talks about how, you know, people attain, it says that we don't attain unity with God the way a drop of water attains unity with the ocean. With all due respect to Eastern religions, a lot of them do not believe in the reality of the individual. They believe the individual is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I love about the family concept is that you have the individual is, you know, in God's family, the individual is loved as an individual, but then you also are part of a greater whole. So you have both.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah, yeah. How are we doing on time, Larry?
We're down to under a minute left.
Yeah.
Well, listen, tell people again how they can get your wonderful book, The Meta Values Breakthrough by Larry Mullen.
Well, it's on Amazon, and it's also on CEORead.com. And in the bookstore, you can order it. It's from Morgan James Publishers.
Okay. And the author, again, is Larry Mullins, Mullins. Larry, thanks so much. Time has flown by really fast.
It's been fun.
And I appreciate you being on the air. We'll definitely have you on again. And God bless you for your work. And it's been sweet.
Thank you for your work, buddy.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. All right. We will see you guys, everybody, next week. I am lining up guests as we speak. I can't tell you who it is yet, but I will know in the next couple of days. We've got a bunch of outside-the-box authors coming up, people who are not readers of the Urantia book, but who are on the cutting edge of religion, spirituality, you name it, whatever you want to call it. And so we will be with you again next week here on The Cosmic Citizen. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Larry.
You bet. Thank you, buddy.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet, the letter X, net.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.